and A Night with a Vampire 2.
Good evening. Please, leave the light on. Tonight, we begin a new series of nightly vigils dedicated to the thirsty undead. Alas for Angela Carter, untimely dead. But after death, walking amongst us still, and telling us in her immortal, beguiling voice of the Lady of the House of Love. Wearing an antique bridal gown, the beautiful Queen of the Vampires sits all alone in her dark, high house. She rises when the sun sets and goes immediately to her table where she plays her game of patience until she grows hungry, until she becomes ravenous. A chignoned priest of the Orthodox faith staked out her wicked father at a Carpathian crossroad before her milk teeth grew. Just as they staked him out, the fatal count cried, "Nosferatu is dead. Long live Nosferatu." Now, she possesses all the haunted forests and mysterious habitations of his vast domain. But the Countess herself is indifferent to her own weird authority, as if she were dreaming it. In her dream, she would like to be human, but she does not know if that is possible. The tarot always shows the same configuration. Always she turns up la papesse, la mort, la tour abolie, wisdom, death, dissolution. On moonless nights, her keeper lets her out into the garden. All the roses her dead mother planted have grown up into a huge spiked wall. When the back door opens, the Countess will sniff the air and howl. Everything about this beautiful and ghastly lady is as it should be. Queen of night, queen of terror. Except her horrible reluctance for the role. Nevertheless, if an unwise adventurer pauses in the square of the deserted village to refresh himself at the fountain, a crone in a black dress and white apron presently emerges from a house. She will invite you with smiles and gestures. You will follow her. The Countess wants fresh meat. When she was a little girl, she was like a fox, and contented herself entirely with baby rabbits that squeaked piteously as she bit into their necks with a nauseated voluptuousness. But now she is a woman. She must have men. One hot, ripe summer, a young officer in the British Army, blonde, blue-eyed, heavy-muscled, visiting friends in Vienna, decided to spend the remainder of his furlough exploring the little-known uplands of Romania. He has the special quality of virginity. Ignorance, yet at the same time power in potentia, and furthermore, unknowingness, which is not the same as ignorance. He hopes to find a friendly inn to rest the night. He's hot, hungry, thirsty, weary, dusty. At first, such disappointment to discover the roofs of all the cottages caved in and tall weeds thrusting through the piles of fallen tiles. But the fountain where the village women used to wash their clothes still gushed out bright, clear water. He gratefully washed his feet and hands, applied his mouth to the faucet, then let the icy stream run over his face. When he raised his dripping, gratified head, he saw, silently arrived beside him in the square, an old woman. She bobbed a curtsy at the young man and beckoned him to follow her. A great, intoxicated surge of the heavy scent of red roses blew into his face as soon as they left the village, inducing a sensuous vertigo. Too many roses bloomed on enormous thickets that lined the path, their whorled, tightly budded cores outrageous in their implications. The mansion emerged grudgingly out of this jungle. The old lady unlocked the door and took him to a little chamber and bustled about to get him a bottle of wine and a glass. While he bemusedly drank his wine, she disappeared, but soon returned bearing a steaming platter of the local spiced meat stew. When he'd put away his plateful, the old woman came and gestured he should leave the table and follow her once again. She made a pantomime of drinking. He deduced he was now invited to take after-dinner coffee in another room. He was surprised to find how ruinous the interior of the house was. But the mute crone resolutely wound him on the reel of her lantern down endless corridors. At last she paused, and behind the door where they'd halted, he heard, wonderfully, the liquid cascade of the song of a lark. The crone rapped with her knuckles on the panels. The most seductively caressing voice he had ever heard in his life softly called out, "Entrez?" First of all, he saw only a shape. This shape resolved itself into that of all things, a hoop-skirted dress of white satin draped here and there with lace, a dress 50 or 60 years out of fashion, but once, obviously, intended for a wedding. And then he saw the girl who wore the dress, a girl with the fragility of the skeleton of a moth. As his eyes grew accustomed to the half-dark, he saw how beautiful and how very young the bedizen scarecrow was. The Countess stood behind a low table, beside a pretty, silly, gilt-and-wire birdcage. Her huge dark eyes almost broke his heart with their waif-like lost look, yet he was disturbed, almost repelled by her extraordinarily fleshy mouth. A mouth with wide, full, prominent lips of a vibrant purplish crimson, a morbid mouth. He thought she must be only 16 or 17 years old, no more, with the hectic, unhealthy beauty of a consumptive. She was the chatelaine of all this decay. With many tender precautions, the crone now raised the light she held to show his hostess her guest's face. At that, the Countess let out a faint, mewing cry and made a blind, appalled gesture with her hands, as if pushing him away, so that she knocked against the table and a butterfly dazzle of painted cards fell to the floor. Tisking under her breath, the crone busily poked about on the table until she found an enormous pair of dark green glasses, such as blind beggars wear, and perched them on the Countess's nose. He'd retrieved the cards and put her toys back into a hand so slender you could almost see the frail net of bone beneath the translucent skin. At his touch, she seemed to revive a little, and almost smiled, raising herself upright. The crone found him a chair and departed, leaving the room a little darker. "See how I'm ready for you? I've always been ready for you. I've been waiting for you in my wedding dress. Why have you delayed for so long? It will all be over very quickly. You will feel no pain, my darling." Since he himself is immune to shadow due to his virginity, he does not yet know what there is to be afraid of. And, due to his heroism, which makes him like the sun, he sees before him, first and foremost, an inbred, highly strung girl child, fatherless, motherless, kept in the dark too long and pale as a plant that never sees the light, half blinded by some hereditary condition of the eyes, and though he feels unease, he cannot feel terror. He will learn to shudder in the trenches, but this girl cannot make him shudder. She has not eaten for 3 days. It is dinner time. It is bedtime. A ghastly hunger gnaws her entrails. She has waited for him all her life without knowing it. The handsome guest, scarcely believing his luck, will follow her into her bedroom. She will assure him, in the very voice of temptation, "My clothes have but to fall, and you will see before you a succession of mysteries." Tomorrow, her keeper will bury his bones under her roses. The food her roses feed on gives them their rich colour, their swooning odour, that breathes lasciviously of forbidden pleasures.
"Suivez-moi."
The handsome guest, fearful for his hostess's health, her sanity, gingerly follows her hysterical imperiousness into the other room. He would like to take her into his arms and protect her from the ancestors who leer down from the walls. What a macabre bedroom. She is shaking as if her limbs were not efficiently joined together, as if she might shake into pieces. She raises her hands to unfasten the neck of her dress, and her eyes well with tears. They trickle down beneath the rim of her dark glasses. She can't take off her mother's wedding dress unless she takes off her dark glasses. She has fumbled the ritual. It is no longer inexorable. When she takes off the dark glasses, they slip from her fingers and smash to pieces on the tiled floor. She gapes blindly down at the splinters. What is she to do now? When she kneels to try to gather the fragments of glass together, a sharp sliver pierces deeply into the pad of her thumb. She cries out. She watches the bright bead of blood form a drop. She has never seen her own blood before, not her own blood. It exercises upon her an odd fascination. Into this vile and murderous room, the handsome guest brings the innocent remedies of the nursery. He gently takes her hand away from her and dabs the blood with his own handkerchief, but still it spurts out. And so he puts his mouth to the wound. He will kiss it better for her, as her mother, had she lived, would have done. Her painted ancestors turn away their eyes and grind their fangs. How can she bear the pain of becoming human? He was awakened by lark song. The shutters were all opened up and light and air streamed in. His bones were stiff and aching. He'd slept on the floor with his bundled up jacket for a pillow after he'd put her to bed. He padded into the boudoir, his mind busy with plans. We shall take her to Zurich, to a clinic. She will be treated for nervous hysteria, then to an eye specialist for her photophobia, and to a dentist to put her teeth into better shape. We shall turn her into the lovely girl she is. I shall cure her of all these nightmares. In the desolation of the boudoir, she sits at her round table in her white dress, with the cards laid out before her. She is not sleeping. In death, she looked far older, less beautiful, and so, for the first time, fully human. I will vanish in the morning light. I was only an invention of darkness. And I leave you as a souvenir the dark, fanged rose. At Bucharest, much later, when he changed back into uniform in his quarters, he discovered he still had the Countess's rose. Curiously enough, the flower did not seem to be quite dead, and on impulse, because the girl had been so lovely and her death so unexpected and pathetic, he decided to try and resurrect her rose. He filled his tooth glass with water from the carafe on his locker and popped the rose into it, so that its withered head floated on the surface. When he returned from the mess that evening, the heavy fragrance of Count Nosferatu's roses drifted down the stone corridor of the barracks to greet him, and his Spartan quarters brimmed with the reeling odour of a glowing, velvet, monstrous flower, whose petals had regained all their former bloom and elasticity, their corrupt, brilliant, baleful splendour. Next day, his regiment embarked for France. Tomorrow night, we shall cross the Atlantic, where I shall surely demonstrate the extraordinary power of an arresting image. Until then, sleep well, if you can.
David Tennant was the reader. The stories are abridged by Robin Brooks. It was produced by Clive Brill for Pacificus Productions and BBC Radio 4.